I'm Ben. I'm here with Charlie, and we're interviewing Professor Stirl Finney from Caltech. Stirl is a professor of theoretical astrophysics and also an executive officer for astronomy and astrophysics. He did his bachelor's degree at Caltech in 1980 before moving on to do a PhD at Cambridge in 1983 under the supervision of Lord Martin Rees, who is now the Astronomer Royal. He's here today to do a talk on turning low-mass X-ray binaries into millisecond pulsars and back, again and again. Hi, Stirl. Thanks for joining us on the Jodcast.
Pleasure to be here.
So, you're here to do a talk today on how low-mass X-ray binaries evolve to and from millisecond pulsars. Could you give us an idea of what those two objects actually are and how we think they effectively turn into each other?
Right. So X-ray binaries are neutron stars orbited by a companion star, which is so close to it that it's losing mass, and the mass is then falling onto the neutron star after spiraling in orbits around the neutron star. And when it falls down, it emits about 10% of its rest mass energy in heat, and that heat makes the surface of the neutron star very hot, so it glows in X-rays. That's why they're called X-rays, because they emit X-ray, and binaries, because there's a companion star supplying the mass, so it's two stars. The millisecond pulsars, most of them also are binaries, so there's a neutron star and a star orbiting it. And in some cases, it is close enough that mass is falling onto it. In other cases, it's not quite close enough. And people have long suspected that these two are related to each other. And the traditional story for 30 or 40 years now has been that X-ray binaries accrete mass onto the neutron star. And as they do that, the neutron star spins faster and faster as it gets angular momentum. It buries the magnetic field of the neutron star, and that's how you make rapidly spinning low magnetic field neutron stars like the ones we see in the millisecond pulsars. And then the companion star, when it has lost enough mass, it shrinks, and it's all supposed to stop. And the big puzzle of the last few years is that we've seen pulsars with millisecond pulsars with companions, which turned into X-ray binaries and then turned back into millisecond pulsars, and in one case has done it again. And it was supposed to happen once every 100 million years. We've now seen several changes in the last 10 years, so there's clearly a problem with the standard story.
What does the observational signature look like of this switch?
So the switch is basically the X-rays drop dramatically in luminosity, so the accretion, the matter falling onto the neutron star, almost completely stops. And then the radio emission, which is sort of believed to come from just the sort of naked spinning neutron star, turns on again. And then when the accretion, when the X-rays brighten up, then the radio disappears again, so it's sort of a switch between the two states.
So the fact that it's accreting actually prevents the pulsar from emitting in the radio.
Right, it stops the radio pulsations. And in some cases, we still see weak X-ray pulsations because parts of the neutron star are hotter than other parts. So you can still see X-ray modulation, but the radio turns off.
Is that because the radio signal is actually being absorbed, or is it because it's being prevented from falling onto the certain parts of the neutron star?
I think most people thought it was being prevented. I think it's now recent results have made it less clear. I think nature is often more sophisticated than simple theories.
So do we have simultaneous data from X-ray and radio telescopes that show these switches happening together in both bands?
In one case, we were very lucky and it was nearly simultaneous. Typically, it's hard to get continuous time coverage, so typically there's sort of days or weeks gap, so the time of the switch is not generally known very more precisely than a day or a week, but in one case it clearly was switching quite rapidly.
And the process of observing in the radio and in the X-ray is very different. Am I right in thinking that most X-ray telescopes come from space, are based in space?
Yeah, I think all X-ray telescopes are based in space because the X-rays don't get through the Earth's atmosphere, so the only way to see them is to go above the atmosphere.
So what do we know about the evolutionary history of the two stars that eventually will come together to produce a system like this? While these stars are on the main sequence, what type of stars are we talking about?
To make a neutron star, it's believed you need to start with a star whose mass is greater than about 10 or 12 times the mass of the Sun, so maybe 10 to 30 times the mass of the Sun. But the companions for the both the X-ray binaries and the Milosic and pulsars all seem to be descendants of stars like the Sun, or even a bit less massive than the Sun, maybe a little bit more massive than the Sun, but essentially Sun-like. But in many cases, what we see are just tiny little remnants of them. In the simplest cases, the fate of the Sun, if it's left on its own, is to it will become a red giant, and then a second phase of red, extreme red giant evolution that will lose some of its envelope and end its life as a white dwarf whose mass is a half or a little more than a half the present mass of the Sun. We see pulsars with white dwarfs orbiting them, which clearly have just evolved and lost their mass, but in this case onto the neutron star rather than into interstellar space. But in many of the most interesting X-ray binaries, they're actually little stars of about from 3/10 the mass of the Sun to even just the mass of Jupiter. The typical ones are a few hundredths of the mass of the Sun. And in those cases, what's believed to have happened is that even before the star had evolved to become a red giant, it was already losing mass to the neutron star. And so what you're seeing is just sort of little, the last little bits of the star as it's already lost 98% of its mass onto the neutron star. So,
In the terms of neutron star populations as a whole, how common or rare are binary neutron stars with companions? Because to have a neutron star, you've got to have a supernova. So does that usually disrupt a bound system?
Yeah, so is roughly 99% of the... We believe that most neutron stars, like most stars, actually were born in binaries. So the typical star is not like the Sun, but it actually has one or more companions orbiting it. But the neutron stars, by and large, are single for exactly the reason you mentioned, that there's a big explosion, a lot of mass is lost, the neutron star gets a recoil velocity, and so probably 99 times out of 100, the neutron star loses its companion. So the X-ray binaries and millisecond pulsars are descendants of the lucky 1%, which retained their companion. But they're actually quite common observationally, because once they get... ordinary pulsars that are born in supernova explosions only last for about 10 million years, whereas the ones that are recycled in the binaries and spun up and have their magnetic field lowered last for, say, 500 times longer than that. So even though they're being born at a very small rate, they live 500 times longer, so they're roughly equal numbers, actually, that we can see.
Just coming back to something you said a few minutes ago about sometimes the companion star is as low mass as Jupiter, presumably it has quite a low luminosity. So is there any way of actually seeing these companions in the optical? Can we actually see this system and separate the two objects?
So we can see them in two ways. One is the thing that I've been spending a lot of time for the last couple of years is that the pulsar, in many of these cases, is losing energy, its rotational energy, in very relativistic particles and gamma rays with a luminosity which can be, say, 100 times larger than that of the Sun. And so these poor little remains of stars next to them, which are about the radius of the Sun away from the neutron star, are being blasted by these gamma rays and relativistic particles, and they're heated up to very high temperatures. So most of their luminosity is actually not their own intrinsic luminosity that they're generating or the heat they're losing from the center, but it's actually re-radiating the heat that's being put on them. So it's just like the Earth would be very cold if you took the Sun away, but the warmth of our Earth is provided by the Sun. And in this case, the warmth of these companion stars and planets around the pulsars is actually being provided by the pulsar. But it's not somewhere you would like to live, right? It's being like in the living, being heated up to roasty temperatures by a proton beam, an accelerator that has big radioactivity to stay away warnings on it.
And aside from being heated up by these massive blasts of radiation, is there anything else that happens to the companion stars? Do they change in form or shape?
The heating causes them to swell up. Essentially, it bottles up heat that would be trying to escape from the center of the stars. So many of these stars, even though they're very low mass and would ordinarily be very small stars, in fact, are observed to be much bigger than they ought to be. And that's one of the topics that I've been working on, is understanding how they get swelled up by the external heating.
Is that mainly the surface layers of the star, or does it go right to the core? Can it disrupt the fusion in the star itself?
Yeah, in fact, I've shown that some of the stars, the lower mass ones, can be swelled up so much that the temperature and density in their center gets dropped so much that the fusion in the center completely turns off, and so they're basically just living on the residual heat plus the heat from the pulsar on the outside. Yeah, so it has very dramatic effects on them.
So what would be the ultimate fate of a system like this?
I think that's one of the still unresolved questions. When these systems were first discovered, it was seen that you can actually observe plasma being blown off these stars that we can see, because it causes delays in the radio pulses and absorption of the radio pulses from them. So people thought, aha, there are millisecond pulsars which don't have companions, but we think must have had them in the past, because otherwise they couldn't be made to spin that rapidly if they hadn't accreted material. But there's some which don't have any companion at all. And so it was thought that maybe you could just evaporate the companions into nothingness by this process, and then you would be left with a single millisecond pulsar. I think that's less clear now, that the amount of material that's being lost is probably not enough to completely evaporate the stars, and so they may end up as sort of just Jupiter's or a few times Jupiter's mass orbiting the companion star and not completely disappeared. But I think that's an interesting and still unsolved question.
That's a pretty cool thing to think about, actually. Thinking about compact objects in binary systems rotating around each other immediately brings to mind a topical subject that we were listening to just last week, which is generation of gravitational waves. So you are also very heavily involved in gravitational waves and searching for them. But first, could you tell us a little bit about whether we'd ever be able to detect gravitational waves from a system like these millisecond pulsar companion systems that you're describing?
Not from most of them. If the European Space Agency and maybe NASA build the laser interferometer space antenna, which is sensitive to much lower frequency gravitational waves than the LIGO, which announced its discovery last week, some of the nearby pulsar binaries could be detected with LISA in our own galaxy, and that would be interesting, but probably not earth-shaking. LISA would also detect hundreds of thousands of other white dwarf binaries in our galaxy and merging black holes of much bigger masses into the early universe. But I think that's not the primary goal of gravitational waves. I think this would not be learning about these systems particularly.
So LIGO announced last Thursday that gravitational waves had actually been detected from a pair of black holes that were spinning around each other. And I don't think it's any exaggeration to say that that has opened up an entirely new era of astronomy.
Yeah, it has.
So could you tell us a little bit, were you involved at all in the press conference? Were you watching it? Were you there? What were you doing when they were announced?
I was watching the press conference. I'd just been on a PhD exam in the Netherlands, and they, in the room next door, they screened the press conference. So because I'm from Caltech, where LIGO is headquartered and where it's been built and designed and for the last 30-plus years, I had heard lots of rumors and increasingly precise rumors before the press conference, so maybe it wasn't a great surprise to me. But still, I mean, it's a wonderful culmination, I guess. I arrived at Caltech in 1985, and my colleagues there had put in three times a proposal to the National Science Foundation to start design work on what became LIGO, and been turned down every time. And finally, in the second year that I was at Caltech in 1987, the first of the LIGO proposals was accepted. Yeah, in 1991, after the second double neutron star system was discovered, I figured out how to calculate the rate. And that rate of merging neutron stars was used in the sort of setting the sensitivity goals for what eventually became advanced LIGO. So, yeah, so it's been a very, very long time, and it's wonderful to see the
fruit. Were you one of the physicists who placed a bet on gravitational waves being detected before 2010?
No, I did not. I did not place any bets. Perhaps I should have taken big odds. I think some of my colleagues were very optimistic. I was always a bit pessimistic. I mean, I was optimistic that they would eventually be discovered, but I wasn't optimistic that the rates were as high as some people thought. And
so you were there somewhere underneath, your calculations were there in advanced LIGO. Were you going to be up for a Nobel Prize?
No, I think the people who deserve the Nobel Prize are the people who actually built that amazingly sensitive experiment, I think.
So coming back to the science of what was actually announced on Thursday, could you tell us a little bit about what was announced and what it looked like?
So the announcement was the detection of gravitational waves from two black holes, each roughly 30 times the mass of the Sun, which were caught in their final phases of spiraling together. And the reason they spiral together is because as they orbit each other, they wiggle space-time, and the wiggles propagate out as gravitational waves, and that takes orbital energy from the black holes. So the black hole orbits shrink just like a satellite in the Earth's atmosphere loses energy to the atmosphere and spirals in until it hits the ground. But here, rather than heat, it's gravitational waves that was taking the energy away. So we saw the last couple of tenths of a second of this in spiral. And then you can actually see the waveforms, which are astonishingly close to the very first waveform for such an object that was calculated by a postdoctoral scholar at Caltech, Franz Pretorius, who was the first one to be able to solve Einstein's equations to get black holes to orbit each other for more than once and actually spiral together. And the waveform looks astonishingly like that very first one. The reason I say astonishing is that calculation assumed that the two black holes weren't spinning, and it seems as if these at least were not rapidly spinning, which would have changed the waveform, so they really looked like they were two slowly rotating black holes, which merged and produced a more rapidly spinning black hole.
Could you tell us a little bit about how you can detect the spin of a black hole?
So the spin of a black hole in binary, which you see from the gravitational waves, so there are basically two stages. So in the stage when the two black holes are orbiting each other, if they're spinning and the spins are not parallel to each other, so they're spinning sort of each in a different direction, then the plane of the orbit gets warped up and down, and so you see a modulation of the signal as the black holes precess around the orbital axis, and then that causes the orbit plane to wobble up and down. And we didn't see any of that wobbling in this system. The other way that you can determine spin is in the final black hole after the two collide with each other. You see what's called ring down, and that's the black hole is not a smooth stationary object, but it's a perturbed black hole because it's just formed from the merger of two. And so it wobbles around and radiates gravitational waves from the wobbles. And if it's spinning rapidly, then there are different kinds of wobbles and they occur more rapidly. And so you can measure the spin of the final one by looking at the last wobbles as it settles itself down.
And looking at the final, the graph, which was shown by LIGO, the ring down is the attenuating.
Yeah, it's sort of the fading at the end after the peak when the two black holes first merge, then you get the peak emission, and then it gradually tails off as it settles down into one smooth black hole, which doesn't radiate anymore.
And another amazing thing about the final product is how accurately you can measure things like the final spin and the final mass of the black hole. And that's all tied up in the original equations, which have been solved. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. The precision comes from matching the waveform to actual supercomputers' calculations of what Einstein's equations actually predict very precisely. If you want only a rough estimate, it's sort of fairly easy to get an idea because the gravitational waves come out at twice the orbital frequency, and so as the two black holes spiral together, the orbital frequency goes up, and that's why you see the frequency rising. And then when the two black holes' horizons start merging, that's the end of the signal. And so from looking at the frequency of the waves before the peak of the emission and the frequency at the peak of emission, you can essentially get the masses of the two black holes and the mass of the final black hole approximately. But if you want to a few percent precision, then you have to compare with the supercomputer calculations.
And you can also fairly accurately tell the distance to the final black hole, which is something that I didn't think about very well beforehand. But could you explain how we can so accurately determine the distance to something that we can't really see.
Yeah, so it's a little bit like if you had a telescope and you were looking at a light bulb and the light bulb had a gigantic sign on it that said 100 watts, then because it had the sign on it that said 100 watts, you could measure how much light you were getting at your eye or your detector at your telescope, and then from comparing those two, you could determine the distance by seeing how the farther away it is, the fainter it would look. But just since it says 100 watts, you know exactly how bright.
So this is the same principle as using type 1a supernova as standard candles.
It's even better than that, because type 1a supernovae, they don't actually come with an answer that says how bright they are. We've seen them in nearby galaxies, and we think the distant ones are kind of like the nearby ones, and we apply corrections. But the gravitational waves are really much more precise, because the thing which is causing the orbit to spiral together is the loss of energy in gravitational waves. And since you can see the frequency of the orbit going up, you know exactly the rate at which energy is being lost to gravitational waves. And then when you measure the amplitude of the gravitational wave signal, it's just like seeing how faint the light bulb is. But in this case, you know exactly how much energy was being emitted because you can see the frequency changing. So it's really like the one that says I'm 100 watts. You know exactly how much power is being emitted.
So it's a distance measurement that's completely independent to the electromagnetic spectrum.
Yeah.
That would open up loads of implications for more physics that hasn't really been considered before.
I think it is probably most likely to work the other way, that because we know the distances to these events, if we start looking for electromagnetic signals, maybe not from two black holes, but from two neutron stars or neutron star black hole systems, which also ought to be detected by LIGO, if there's any question about the identification, we can compare the distance to the electromagnetic source to the distance from the gravitational wave source and be more sure that it's correct. And that's important because from the gravitational waves alone, the positions are never going to be very good. And the positions for this case is, sort of like looking through a window and saying it's somewhere out through that window. And in the best cases, it will be kind of like saying it's somewhere in your hand held at arm's length in the sky. And there's hundreds of thousands of galaxies in those regions. So being sure that you've got the right one, it'll be useful to have the distance information.
How could we better localize where this event happened?
So there's some room for improvement. So this initial detection was just based on the two LIGO detectors in the United States, which were the only ones operating and sensitive enough to see it. there's a similar detector being constructed near Pisa in Italy, which hopefully will come online near the end of 2016. And with three detectors, you can determine the position much more accurately than just with two. It will get even better when another detector, LIGO, has sent copies of its equipment to India, and there will be a LIGO India, which was just approved last week by the Indian government. And that one will localize things. But again, it will still only be like your hand at arm's length. Mm. So for really determining, which galaxy and where in the galaxy it is, it's going to depend on finding some kind of radio or light signal from it, that it will be coincident in time and distance, and people will just have long arguments about whether that was the right association, but hopefully some of them will become clear enough that we can really confidently determine it.
So the event that was reported last Thursday, there was absolutely no electromagnetic counterpart to that event.
Lots of people looked for electromagnetic counterparts. Lots of things go bump in the sky. When you look over a very large area for things that go bump, and there have been claims that there was a bump in the gamma rays.
Okay.
I think, it's very hard to be confident that they were actually associated with the gravitational waves, but there's an enormous effort by lots of astronomers who were very excited about finding counterparts. With the two black holes, if it's two black holes without any matter around them, there's no reason at all to expect any electromagnetic radiation at all, because it's just two pieces of vacuum space-time putting each other together, and there's no reason to excite radio or X-ray or optical waves at all. So it would be a great surprise for physics if that were discovered and real. There's a huge effort, and as I say, the LIGO should also be detecting events involving disruption of neutron stars, and then the material that's thrown out, you'll have radioactive decay of the neutron-rich material, and there should be sort of miniature supernovae associated with those. So there's an enormous effort to look for things, and I hope they'll succeed soon.
I'm curious to know that if we could actually have seen this event electromagnetically, if the luminosity of this black hole event was electromagnetic, what would it compare to? Say, how bright would it be compared to, say, a core collapse supernova or a gamma ray burst?
I think the best way to say it is if our eyes were sensitive to the gravitational waves and could actually absorb all of them, this event would have been much brighter than the full moon at Earth, even though it's 1.2 billion light years away. It would have been, for the tenth of a second, it would have been brighter than the full moon.
So a very brief new full moon.
Right.
I wonder how many times they go off in the... do you know if there's any particular rate that's been estimated? This is only one event.
It was seen in only 16 days of data, and I think all the evidence is that that's about the rate. That there's one of these that near enough for LIGO to see, roughly one every couple of weeks. That's still LIGO. This event was relatively nearby in the sort of in the sense of the total size of the universe. So I think if you ask out to a sort of redshift of one encompassing half the life and half the galaxies in the universe, there's probably more than one a day of this sort of event happening.
An interesting point that LIGO is sensitive to, is it right to say LIGO is sensitive to the whole sky? With electromagnetic telescopes, you've got the Earth in the way, but with gravitational waves, they flow right through the Earth.
Yeah, so this event, the best localization that LIGO was able to provide was that it was actually in the southern sky, but it was detected by the two LIGO detectors in North America. So the gravitational waves went through the Earth to the LIGO detectors rather than coming from above. So, passing through the Earth is no problem at all for gravitational waves.
Do gravitational waves get attenuated at all? Because if I throw a stone into a pond and the ripples sort of spread out, the internal friction in the water will... The amplitude of those waves will gradually decrease the further you go away from the source. Is the same true of gravitational waves?
In principle, yes. So as the gravitational waves propagate through the universe, they're wiggling everything in the universe up and down. So they do lose energy. And in particular, the most effective way is if they pass by binary star systems where there are two masses that can couple to them. So in principle, they lose a bit of energy. In practice, even going from one edge of the universe to the other, the amount of energy loss is really tiny. Mm. So there's a little bit, but it's not like the pond that if you wait long enough, it will become completely still. The gravitational waves can happily go across the universe, and they could still keep going if if the universe had been around long enough for them to have kept going.
And this is happening all the time with lots and lots of different sources all over the universe. Mm. So really, even though we can't detect it just yet, there is this background of interfering waves that's moving around all the time.
Yeah, so the LIGO is really just opening up the beginning. LIGO is sort of sensitive to gravitational waves whose frequency is like that of sort of the lower half of the piano keyboard, sort of 30 hertz up to middle C, roughly, is the range that LIGO is sensitive to. But there's a whole huge spectrum of, in particular, the most interesting are lower frequency waves. So I mentioned the laser interferometer space antenna, which is somewhat similar to LIGO, but with arms instead of 4 kilometers, arms of millions of kilometers long.
Yeah, Ben referred to it earlier as LIGO in space, and you were the chairman of it
I was chair of the mission definition team for LISA many years ago. It's rather different than LIGO. It's really more like precision clock timing. So it's rather than bouncing the light back and forth, you measure single pass, but it's sensitive to gravitational waves with periods of minutes to hours. And those are produced by black holes not of 10 to 30 times the mass of the sun, but black holes like the one in the center of our galaxy of 4 million solar masses, and our nearest companion galaxy, the Andromeda Galaxy, which is about 30 million solar masses. And the Andromeda Galaxy and our galaxy are falling together, and in about 5 billion years, our two galaxies will merge. And the two black holes in the center of M31 in our galaxy will spiral together and produce a really spectacular burst of gravitational waves.
Not brighter than the full moon.
much brighter than the full moon if we were still around to see it. There you would get out about 10 to the fifth times more energy than from this event that LIGO saw, but it would be a much lower frequency because they're bigger black holes, so when they touch each other, they're orbiting each other at lower frequencies, and LISA would be able to see those out to the really early universe, redshifts above 10 or 20. So, and then at even lower frequencies, before they get into that final stage, they're black holes orbiting each other with periods of thousands of years, which one could detect from pulsar timing, for example.
So how far off are we from creating a map, the equivalent of the Planck maps for the cosmic microwave background, for the stochastic background of gravitational waves? Is that one of the ultimate aims of gravitational wave astronomy?
So I think so Planck or similar experiments in the microwave background, there's a possibility that there were gravitational waves created at the end of the very early expansion of the universe, so the so-called inflationary part of the universe. And
would that be before the surface of last scattering?
Yeah, so this would be, they would be created long before the cosmic microwave background. So the cosmic microwave background had its last scattering when the universe was about 400,000 years old. And these gravitational waves would have been created when the universe was maybe 10 to the minus 30 seconds old and have been propagating without being absorbed ever since. But they would modulate, they would move the surface of last scattering around a little bit. So there's an enormous effort at Caltech and elsewhere looking for these polarization signals they might introduce in the cosmic microwave background. So those would be really low frequency gravitational waves with periods of billions of years. There's also a possibility that in phase transition in the universe, which happened when the universe had again, long before the last scattering, when the temperature of the universe was corresponded to energies similar to that of the Large Hadron Collider of tera electron volts, that there may have been a phase transition, so-called electroweak phase transition, which might also have produced gravitational waves if it was a first-order transition. Those would be squarely in the middle of the LISA, laser interferometer space antenna's frequency band, so there is a great interest in looking for a stochastic background at that frequency, which would constrain models of particle physics. And then there's also the background produced by all the binary black holes and binary neutron stars and everything in the universe. And there, I think it's probably more likely that we'll see individual sources. The thing which ultimately limits the sensitivity of the laser interferometer space antenna is actually the background of binary stars in the Milky Way and in all the other Milky Ways throughout the universe, which produce just the noise from all these little white dwarfs buzzing around each other with minutes to hour periods. And there's just so many of them in the universe that they produce an isotropic din of noise, which means that there's not much point building an instrument more sensitive than that because there's already so much noise in the universe at those frequencies.
It is very cool that up until now, the furthest we could look back in time was to the cosmic microwave background, but now potentially we have a window right back to the beginning of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Or a hearing aid.
We can hear what was going on, yes.
Well, we better let you get on with your talk, which you're about to give us, coming to 3 o'clock. So you'll be talking about what you've just told us about, which is MSPs and low-mass X-ray binaries and their co-relationship. So thank you very much for joining us on the Jodcast.
Okay, it's been a pleasure to be here.
Thank you.